equals burn. The propaganda's win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Words are now displayed with good intentions.
Welcome to 1 of 200, the media and politics podcast. Christ, what a fucking week. Genuinely, every week we say, oh, there's so much happening in the world and we can't get to all of it, but it continues to accelerate. I'm joined by three wonderful co-hosts. We've got PMAX. How you doing, PMAX?
Good. As a teacher of history, it is a fantastic time to be living. Someone obviously clearly said, may you live in interesting times, and unfortunately they were touched by the mandate of heaven. So it's kind of exciting to live through my own kind of Great Depression era. Hopefully we'll have a happier conclusion to it.
Let's keep it global and not personal. We've also got Simone on the line. How are you doing, Simone?
Kia ora, I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. I moving my whole life up here, so things are okay. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Of course, in the world, they're not. But, you know, personally, the thing that only matters, which is me, the protagonist of reality, naturally, yeah.
Yeah, always have to have the caveats these days, eh? It's pretty horrific. And we've got Josephine calling all the way from Christchurch. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm just, you know, I'm up on a Saturday morning. I'm surviving. Good to be here after a while. It is a crazy world that we're living in, so I am, you know, keen to talk about a lot of the stuff that's going on.
Fantastic. Let's get straight into it. We released an episode yesterday about the BDS movement and divestment campaigns happening here in Aotearoa to target ASB over their investments in Motorola. So go have a listen to that. But part of the reason we're trying to cover that stuff is, one, no one else in media here is really doing it, and two, the situation in Gaza just continues to get worse. It's fucking ludicrous. You know, Israel broke the ceasefire every day since the ceasefire came into effect, and then they officially broke it. And how do you raise something above a genocide, right? Israel are doing everything they can to create that world. Hundreds of children sometimes dying in a single day, openly targeting journalists and their families, openly targeting aid workers, openly targeting medical professionals, announcing it. None of the plausible deniability or Hasbara coming through the Western media genocide apologia machine to try and cast the blame elsewhere, or say, oh, you must be mistaken, or, you know, other versions of this. It's just, oh, some people die in Gaza somehow. Josephine, you have been keeping a pretty close eye on this. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. It's just the ultimate brutality of living in a colonial world. You know, growing up in the eras that we have, like millennials or Gen Z or whichever, you know, even from Gen X onwards, we were told that the era of colonialism is in the past. But actually, there hasn't been a more violent colonial era than there is at the moment happening, unfolding before our eyes. This is the peak colonial violence that existed during the peak of, for example, the British Empire. So this, for example, is the peak, and we will be discussing the decline of the US Empire, but it is, you know, in a state of its, you know, violent throes. And it just reminds me of what Amy Cesare talked about, colonialism dehumanizing the colonizer. This is what I'm seeing. So in dehumanizing, you know, the colonial subject so much, as we see today, the bombing of hospitals, the abduction of health workers, the targeting of journalists, the, you know, dismantling of the education system and the community, the teachers, the professors, the students, we're seeing that ultimately, there is a dehumanization of the colonizer happening here. So this is the power of colonial genocide, is that it dehumanizes not only the victims. In fact, they become rehumanized in this process. But who gets ultimately dehumanized is that is the system committing this violence. And that's what I have nothing else to say about this. Like, what are we seeing? There's 100% destruction, for example, of Rafah. We remember that moment when even our prime minister was talking about, the assault on Rafah. Israel needs to take it easy, slow down. Rafah, we don't allow it. But look at what happened to Rafah today. And, our government is yet to condemn the Israeli government. So, who is getting dehumanized ultimately here? It is ultimately the colonizer also gets dehumanized through this process.
I think looking at Rafah is quite instructive, seeing all of those images and it being razed, not a single building left, in sight. And I think it's reminiscent of the United States in the Korean War and how there were almost no, not only military targets left, but civilian targets left in the north of the Korean Peninsula by the end. And the United States struggling to find more things to bomb because they wanted to bomb, because they wanted to find targets, because they wanted to test weapons, because, right? This eradication ideology and the sheer force of that as it comes into contact with human bodies. And there's something so disturbing about seeing a site of a crime so clear that it can be seen from space. And much of the world, i.e. the Imperial Core, which controls really the structure of the world, being silent about it. Sometimes worse. Sometimes you do get these moments of clarity from, the Trump administration where it's this is good actually. These are, that they just kind of come out and say it, but it's difficult to stomach and it's difficult to comprehend the scale of the crime and the scale of the silence and the complicity in it. And from the side of New Zealand, I occasionally do see people saying, oh no, New Zealand is somewhat neutral in this. Setting aside that neutrality in the face of genocide is complicity, that's also not true. At the very start of this, New Zealand should have severed all of its diplomatic relations with Israel. It should not be allowed for somebody with an Israeli passport to be here. There should not be an ambassador. All of this should have been done at the very start because it was clear. And looking where we are now, they seem to have somewhat stuck to the guns. Winston Peters, a veteran politician and in some respects diplomat, ought to know better and does know better. And I just want to know if the price is worth it for them at the end of it all.
Yeah, the failure of both politicians and the media here has never been more stark, right? You say this stuff should have happened right near the beginning of this escalation. And we've had moment after moment, massacre after massacre since then, where the ambassador could have been called in, right? Like, you need to fucking do something about this, or we are expelling you. We're breaking off ties, like, let alone sanctions, let alone following responsibilities under the Genocide Convention to fucking stop this. And the failure of media, particularly outlets like Radio New Zealand, who are meant to help inform the public, a public, by the way, which is strongly on the side of Palestinians despite the failure of basically every mainstream outlet here, not basically, every mainstream outlet here, the failure of them to effectively cover what is happening.
Yeah.
And can you imagine if it was being effectively covered, the fucking outcry? Like, there's this continued claim that, oh, we can't have people on the ground, it's too dangerous. Or, like, we can't have people on the ground, Israel won't let us be there, so we can't really report on it effectively because that would be like against journalism or something. You have fucking satellite pictures, mate. Like,
It's
you
not
just.
only that, the implication is that Palestinian journalists aren't people.
Yeah. And it's also like, even today, look at the MFAT page on the Israel's genocide. It says Israel-Hamas conflict. The first sentence, actually the second sentence over here, is New Zealand unequivocally condemns the terrorist attacks by Hamas, There has been how many thousand deaths of children? We're sitting at over 20,000 children dead, hundreds of aid workers killed. Where is the condemnation of Israel here? It's a subtle legitimization of the Israeli position, what we see in New Zealand government's response. It still continues to be so. And from a policy perspective, the responses have all been taking the position of, subtle legitimization of the Israeli position and delegitimization and, distrust for the Palestinian position. This is what we see. Like you said, RNZ, even today, like RNZ, BBC, all these massive Western outlets calling it, in the most favorable ways for Israel. How can you soften the blow for Israel? That's how they do it. Hamas-sponsored health ministry. They still use this terminology. They don't say that Netanyahu, in fact, funded Hamas so that they would split the resistance. So when one side of the resistance movement, starts progressing, they will split it so that they don't move towards the statehood of Palestine. So this none of this is discussed in the media. And if Hamas is considered this, singular evil, then why is it that the Israeli state tried to fund it when the other resistance movements were gaining power? Why is this not discussed? So, yeah, it's the biggest scourge of our time. It is, ultimately a cross that humanity is bearing as a whole because of the lack of basically humanity of our leadership. And we have to bear the scourge. We have to be on the streets calling this out, doing whatever we can to stop this in whatever avenues that we can. So BDS is one, or through your unions. I commend the activists who are standing up against this, including Peace Action or Tutahi, who are often targeted by the state now, targeted by Winston Peters, young activists, for example, who stand up against genocide. Fundamentally, the first action that they got really punished for is giving attention to this weapons manufacturing company, which has set up base in Christchurch called Naya, and the Peace Action Otutahi protesters who were targeted by the police, and before that, Winston Peters, they were protesting this weapons company who has some contracts linked to the genocide. So people who are standing up against this in whatever way, I commend them. It's been over a year now. It takes down our energy, our courage, and all that. But those who continue to go forward, I commend them.
This is one of the other things that's happening, right? We've got governments like those of New Zealand who are saying, "Oh, it's bad. Oh, there's not really much we can do though because we're so little. We'll vote against it in the UN or whatever," and then follow suit, like in the US and the UK, with targeting activists in ways we've probably seen before, but which feel like an escalation of their own at the moment. So doing nighttime visits to peace activists and carting them off before then releasing them without charge. Doing stuff like accessing CCTV in some pretty shady ways to try and target activists specifically. This is a fucking police force which is currently bitching about not having enough resources. Why are you spending your resources like going after activist kids, right? It's really worrying. And especially, this first instance that you referred to, Josephine, around Peace Action Otutahi is reminiscent of what we've seen in the UK. In fact, it happened within a week of a police raid in the UK on the Quakers for hosting a peace meeting. I think something which had never happened before. The Quakers have tended to be left alone. But doing activism around Palestine in particular has become this real kind of leading edge of state power support of genocide, because essentially that's what this is.
Yeah, the 17th century is back, baby. We're repressing Quakers. They're gonna have to move to America again. I think, before turning to the secret third thing, which you mentioned, which is the activists here, just touching on two points. I mean, the first is that, something that Josephine sort of mentioned is InFed's website saying, oh, we condemn these Hamas attacks. Like, New Zealand is a signatory to the United Nations Charter. It was a founding member of the United Nations. We hew to and abide by UN General Assembly resolutions. And all of these things legitimize resistance to occupation. Like, resistance to colonial occupation is enshrined in international law. So, not to get too legalistic about it, but New Zealand is contravening its own supposed principles. And InFAT, other than what is the sort of ministerial responsibility and how all of that works with the administrative law, we are really, when once the legitimacy of an international instrument is ratified through our legislation, because we have this kind of dualist system where, like, the king doesn't just say, this is whatever it is, or the government of the day doesn't just say whatever this is, has to be done through parliament. Once that's done, this is the law of this country, and it is not quite unlawful, but certainly highly unorthodox. And it really shows what a farce this is, that MFAT would contravene what is the standard position in international law, to which New Zealand is both a signatory to these instruments and also has continuously supported the legitimacy of the United Nations and also the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, in mediating these sorts of conflicts, right? There's something really unnerving about that, that there is a kind of, people say, oh, why do you single out, this was one of the, common Hasbara lines, right? Why do you single out Israel? It's the only democracy in the Middle East. It's because you're an anti-Semite, isn't it? It's like every country, including New Zealand, is giving these ridiculous special pleading exemptions to Israel. It is the exact opposite of that. Israel is the only country which can get away with calling itself a fucking democracy when it doesn't let most of the population that it holds under lock and key vote. This is absurd. This would be like if women couldn't vote in the United States and we said, oh, but it's such a proud democracy. You would say, no, this is not a
Give
democracy.
us six
So
months, eh? Give us
obviously
six
not.
months.
Yeah, they're trying that, right? But the second point is that clandestine operations have been undertaken by Israel within New Zealand for years. So I said, after the response following October the 7th and the kind of acute part of this genocide was really ramped up by Israel, that New Zealand should have, like, firstly called the ambassador in and secondly just expelled them. Several ties have gone on board with sanctions. This is such a clear and obvious international position, right? But preceding that, there have been these clandestine operations within this country. I'm not sure that Israel should have been there by the time of October the 7th, not only because of its illegitimate occupation, but because it has contravened the sovereignty of New Zealand on multiple occasions. And we have no interest. The successive governments just have, turned a blind eye really to Mossad's operations inside New Zealand. And there is a fusion of our security state and our domestic police state with that of Israel. You can look at, for example, in standard police disclosure, the kinds of forensic tools which are used to analyze somebody's phone. And again, this is something which will come into play with these activists, because I'm sure they'll be trying to seize devices from them. Is this program called Cellebrite? That's an Israeli technology. So there is this fusion of the Israeli state and its technological apparatus under tech capitalism, as well as, of course, the fusion of that going arm in arm with Silicon Valley and the tools that are used there, and or, Palantir, Peter Thiel's sort of companies, and all of these that are in this interconnected web, and New Zealand's own internal security state, and the way that we repress any sort of resistance here or any solidarity either between our population, sorry, within our population or between our population and populations elsewhere. These forms of resistance against the ruling class. And I think it's worth us really understanding how deep those ties go, and understanding that it is not merely that the police are being used as an instrument to attack these activists by levying charges against them, but and trying to break up that sort of resistance, but it's that they don't necessarily need to be told to do anything like that. It is sort of unconsciously understood that these people are a threat, not only to New Zealand, but that our national interest is almost fused with the national interest of Israel and of the United States and of the UK.
One quick little postscript I'd just like to add before we move on is I do think it's worth reflecting, although I haven't fully marshaled my thoughts on this, but it's worth reflecting that the last time there was an apartheid pariah state, New Zealand was one of the few countries in the world that had normal relations with them. So in a way, a lot of this is just sort of a return to form, and hopefully we will see activists give us the ability to look back on that time with pride instead of humiliation.
I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, what you've raised, PMax. Like, it's not even memory holding it, right? Like, what New Zealand did during apartheid South Africa.
But
like,
John Key couldn't remember.
Well, I mean that's right? Like, and there's a reason for that. But the state and, you know, large amounts of the population were in support of South Africa. And we've rewritten it as like, oh, plucky little New Zealand being on the right side of history. No, some people fucking fought and got their heads caved in by the police to put enough pressure on the government to take action. And look, huge shout out to everyone doing the peace activist work, eh? And the Palestine solidarity work.
Incredibly based. I mean, they've elevated themselves to the ranks of some of the greats, spent a night, you know, in police custody, coming out unfazed in their action. So proud of them.
Meanwhile,
Add something a little extra, unless you're moving on from the activist discussion.
No, go, finish it up.
Just as a practical point of, as a little teaching learning point, I'm not going to tell you about protest OPSEC or anything like that. There are people who actually know about that sort of thing who can tell you and give you advice. What I will give you is a little bit of legal advice, which is that many legal aid lawyers, who I presume are the ones that, you know, most of us can sort of afford, they have so many, I don't know what the bar is like in Wellington, but they have so many cases and so many people, and it's so normalized oftentimes for the police and for the Crown to seek onerous conditions for which there is no lawful nexus and no reasonable basis, that sometimes they're just so happy to get you out that they might not necessarily challenge those particular conditions for fear that a judge will rescind granting you bail and refuse your application for bail. So just be aware of that. Make sure in your discussions with your lawyer that you ask them, what are the conditions that the police are seeking? If, for example, it is a non-association condition with other members, give them a plausible narrative as to why that's an unreasonable and onerous bail condition. You know, for example, I don't have any sort of criminal history before, and these people are my friends. I am not going to enter into an action with them because, you know, you don't need to make any sort of argument about that. But, you know, these are just your personal people that I know quite well. It would be quite difficult not to be able to talk with them. You know, maybe this person takes my dog for a walk on Saturdays or something like that, or you're just friends with them, you know, outside of this, and you've never got in trouble with them before, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there can be, you just have to give some kind of personal narrative that the lawyer can use and then put into a legal argument when they make submissions to the judge. So it's quite important that you pick up on those and ask them specifically, what are the police putting forward in the opposition to bail paperwork, or alternatively, just speaking to the liaison prosecutor at court or with the prosecutor who is in the courtroom where you're going to be appearing? What are they seeking specifically so that it's not a surprise? You can give your lawyer instructions and you can give them this personal narrative that they can use. If the judge refuses that and is being quite ornery about it and they nevertheless grant it, I have myself taken cases to the High Court on appeal where they're just a small little ditzy condition where for most lawyers this wouldn't matter and it would be too much time, but you must insist that they do take this to the High Court and have an actual argument about it. And most of the time that sort of thing will be removed because there's no nexus for it, because it's an unreasonable condition, because it's too onerous, because of, you know, X, Y, and Z. There are so many different sort of legal bases for this. But a district court list judge is just going to like hoe through this stuff at a wildly fast rate, and they won't necessarily have time for a good grounding basis for their decision. And they may not even have, you know, when you get the judge notes, any sort of like expression of the reasoning behind their exercise and discretion in doing this. So all of these are good things in your favor. You want to make sure that that happens. Why? Because especially if you are on a curfew, for example, if you took nighttime action, they're going to say, okay, let's say 7 till 7 curfew. What that means is, and rather annoyingly, most people don't know this, during the day you're free. During the night, the police will knock on your door at 2 a.m. and then you'll be awake and then you'll be really tired at work the next day, and they'll keep harassing you because they hate you and they have nothing better to do except for harass you. But they will do this, right? And if you've already got that sort of curfew, that's something which can mitigate that. You know, you can say, well, I'm not going to be doing all of these nighttime actions, but this is very difficult. But you realize that these things all will be quite difficult to keep to and onerous. So just be aware that when you talk to your lawyer and you give those sorts of instructions, that you get them to explain exactly what the conditions that are proposed are going to be. Just as a piece of, this is how you may continue to have an ordinary life, this is how you will not continue to do it. Because how they get you is they put a ridiculous bail condition that will set you up to fail. Then you have bail breaches in your record. The next judge is less likely to set you free. You will be in custody. You will end up pleading out, because by the time you get to a judge alone trial, let alone a jury trial, it will be a year from now. It'll be 18 months from now. You are going to plead out. You will have served well past time served, even if you would normally be found innocent. Guess what? You've got a conviction on your record. So this is the way that they get you. You need to be really careful about every single step of the way. Make sure that your lawyer informs you. I'm sorry, this has been legal corner, but
just a quick thing you wanted to add.
They need your advice. Like you just got to take this. Every protest in this country needs to be smart about this.
I think we need a jingle on both sides of that. I think like that was amazing.
We'll try and cut that one up.
just put it in a separate episode.
Good legal advice.
Legal corner.
Come on, we can be snappier than that. We've got something better in the tank, but we are going to move on because, you know, while these horrible things are happening, the US is flailing around in other ways that display its toppling from the hegemonic position. And the most recent one, and it's going to be something new next week, I am sure, is that Donald Trump came out earlier this week to say, we're putting reciprocal tariffs on all these people, on all these different countries that do business with us. And maybe those tariffs were calculated by ChatGPT, and maybe it was based on trade deficit. And maybe they don't really know what they're doing. And all of these things are true. It's ludicrous. Like, it's so fucked.
I have a first comment to make there. Like, Trump going up there with a physical board with these words. You know, it was like, am I back in the 60s again? Or what's going on? And apparently all the journalists and media had to read it from that board, and there was no other information provided, and everyone was looking at it. And I'm like, the boomers are not letting go of the center stage yet, are they? They're still there. They're still living in their prime. They haven't woken up to the realization that there are different mediums available. It was hilarious to see that. A great Trump meme for all times. I'm pretty sure that's going to be a meme, him, Trump standing with that, you know, the tariff information there. It's a historic moment. It's interesting. Like, what is Trump trying to achieve? You know, is it stupidity? Is it like just a show? I think it's a combination of everything, you know, all of those things, because America caring about its trade deficits is crazy. You know, people, we trade, the whole world trades in their currency. You know, the entire world gives them goods and services for their currency, and they make that shit up in their computers or in their central bank. So they are actually attacking their own empire here. I don't know if Trump realizes that. I don't know what motivates him to do it, but it is the empire in decline, in an accelerated mode. This is the fall of the U.S. empire. If the U.S. dollar devalues, this will be one of the key blows to the U.S. empire. U.S. empire is based on, the primacy of the U.S. dollar in global trade, but also it's based on its, international military industrial complex, which, by the way, is funded by the U.S. dollar. The bill for that in global military industrial complex and the bases, over 1,000 bases across the world, they give trillions of dollars literally every year to maintain this. And a hit on the US dollar would have impacts on the hit on the US empire. So I was watching this when this was happening yesterday. It was so funny. I fell asleep watching the live coverage last night, on the various US channels. I was flicking across to different channels to see what's going on. The funny thing was watching Breaking Points. I don't know if you watched that, but it's Crystal and Sagar. Both of them, they kind of appear, or they show themselves as kind of anti-establishment, critical thinkers, but both Crystal and Sagar were just mourning the fall of the empire. They were like, we have to save the US empire. Ultimately it's the liberals who come to fight for empire. That's what I was seeing on TV. The liberals coming to fight for the remains of the empire to save it. Obviously they might have three or four homes. The devaluation of the dollar and the fall of the US economy would mean bad. Would mean badly for people who have a lot of assets, but it was just hilarious watching people who are supposed critical thinkers. Of course, you can talk about the impacts of this on US economy, US working class, and that, but also take a critical perspective on what this would mean for a new world order. What it would mean for the global South, for example, who after their colonization are paying huge debts and interests back to the colonizers, usually in the US dollar. What does this mean for the rest of the world? It would be refreshing to see a little bit of analysis from that perspective. But obviously we don't see that. We're seeing people from the Bush administration, people from the Obama administration, the two sides of the same coin, kind of coming and saying, we need to protect USA's primacy. We need to protect US dollar. They all expect Trump to withdraw this policy shortly, understanding the folly. So we will see what happens. But I think, people like Javier Milei from Argentina, for example, all the theatrics that he's done, I think they kind of take energy and inspiration from each other in doing these sorts of actions, which are out of the pale from the perspective of the establishment. So what is Trump's objective behind this? I'm not really sure. I can speculate, but it's really fascinating to watch the decline of the empire happening before our eyes.
I think it's specifically, you said this is going to impact US bases across the world and the military industrial complex. Trump really is the peace candidate.
Yeah, I need like a Phormesis gold freak to get into the White House and be like, we're putting it back on the gold standard, boys. Or like, we're doing bimetallism. Like, I need the late 19th century, Will and Jennings Bryan sort of policies to be back. We've got to return to the presidents of the 1890s. That's what I think we need. Here's like a little pro tip. Never stand next to a board where something else can be photo edited onto it as like a famous person or a politician. Just don't do that because people will abuse that.
The thing that's fascinating to me, and Josephine kind of touched on this is a global system that the United States has built to enrich itself to build its own power. And it's just so fascinating to see it willfully destroyed for no discernible benefit. I could understand it if there had been a period of reindustrialization before the tariffs were implemented, but there's almost seem like rhetorically there seems to be this attempt to put the cart before the horse and be like, well, we're going to do tariffs and then that's going to cause the reindustrialization.
As if it can just be done, as if it's like Factorio, right? Like, I just slap down a couple more fucking
We
factories.
got to get some more conveyor belts down.
It's actually absurd to see, and I don't think, usually empires or, powerful global actors, they fail due to overreach, right? Like, they're like, okay, we're doing all this stuff, and now we're going to try and fight everyone at once. We're going to spread too far, and the administrative load is going to become too great, and the empire will collapse under that. But the US is really doing the kind of fucking move fast and break things on itself. And you mentioned Javier Milei in Argentina, same thing. And I just want to draw the New Zealand comparison here. If I mention Milei on X, formerly known as Twitter, the number one type of reply guy that pops up in my feed are ACT Party sock puppets. Like, this is it is globally coordinated. It is a set of ideologies and ideas about recasting the world in some kind of almost manifest destiny sense by taking incredibly destructive actions that will just birth the new hegemony, right? Like, it's so bizarre to watch the level of true believiness that these people have around the way these lunatics operate. Like, that it's and we've talked about this previously on the podcast as well, and we've got a range of different commentators that have worked with us, and you'll see it from us on Twitter and Blue Sky and the like. But there's this dual purpose here, of intent, I think, and I don't know, like, how they envisage this happening, but you got this idea of the network state, right, which is right in that kind of billionaire tech bro kind of space, which is autonomous states outside the nation state model, I guess, where you're able to just go and kind of set one of these up and bring people who believe in your vision and operate within the global, whatever you want to call it, politic. And there's been a lot of discussion around that and a lot of attempts at this by people like Peter Thiel. And ostensibly, this is what we're going to be trying to do with Greenland. This is why they're trying to fucking take over Greenland as well, it sounds like. But alongside that, you have this big push for a new clash of civilizations coming out of, I hesitate to use the word thinkers, but at least talkers. I don't know, like Douglas Murray, who believe that Islam and Christianity are going to face off again, who strongly believe that the every nation state should be an ethno state, because as soon as you have multiculturalism, that causes discontent within the polity, and that's what causes governments to fall. And so you've got these two just horrific views of what the future of human societal organizing should be. This kind of faux tech futurism led by capital, led by the whims of billionaires who want to be these kind of philosopher kings. And I use that term with the most
Definition.
cringe possible. And these people who want predominantly all white ethno states that are Christian, that are able to fight the good fight for Western values or whatever the fuck they're saying at any given point. A lot of what we're seeing happen is people getting in Trump's ear and saying, oh, we need to do this so that they can destabilize the current way that the world is organized. It's like, I mean, it's shock doctrine stuff, right? But on a global scale, we must destroy this. We must do things as quickly as possible so we can tear things down. We're going to take actions which seem small, like destroying some of the administrative functions of the US state, looking at like stuff like USAID or whatever, like global administrative functions. And these can't be undone. Once you've done that, like, sorry, things have irrevocably changed now. Like, you're not rebuilding that quickly enough to resolve it at this point. At least I can't see a way for that to functionally happen under the current conditions.
Something I wanted to sort of tag on there, which has briefly left my brain, is oh yes, this is something that I've posted, and this is very much like self-aggrandizing. I got a Bachelor of Arts posting, but there is an element to this of we saw over the past decade, maybe a little bit more, this devaluing of the humanities as sort of an academic discipline, as a a reason to study. And we're seeing it come home to roost, like, oh no, actually studying human behavior, studying the way that governments work, that societies work, is actually really important. And when you completely disregard that and just ask a language learning model how to do tariffs, you get some pretty terrible results. Yeah, hoping that this ends up with anyone with a Bachelor of Arts becoming some kind of oracle in the post-apocalypse, but I'm not keeping my hopes up.
I don't really think they used ChatGPT. I think there was even a discussion about this in some of the content that I watched, that people actually put it into some of the large language models. What is the good tariff policy? And this wasn't it. So if some people were like, okay, it would have been better if it was AI instead of the Trump administration ruling us, kind of advocating for AI overlords. But I really can't make sense of what's going on in relation to Trump, because it's going to hurt his class in the United States ultimately. But there might be some other, Kyle mentioned, it could be a shock doctrine. A recession would, under neoliberalism, always means funneling of public money into the hands of the corporates, which is, I mean, in general, the function of the government under neoliberal capitalism is the government is a mechanism of taking money from the people and funneling it into the hands of the owner class or the wealthy, right? We can see this across various fields. For example, New Zealand's housing accommodation supplement, for example, instead of building social housing, we're simply giving accommodation supplement, which means that we're taking taxpayer money and giving it to the landlords. So already neoliberalism is doing that, but under crisis, we've seen that neoliberalism responds by giving more and more funneling millions, billions. In the case of the United States, like after COVID, it was like $2 trillion kind of COVID funding, which majority of which went into the hands of the ruling class. So maybe that's a little bit of that's going to be there, but ultimately this is a blow on the empire. Whether this was a calculated one or whether this was Trump kind of trying to consolidate his power, his position in history as a change-making president, for example, and also taking those cues from Javier Milei, and also like Modi in India when he first came into power, he uses these words like surgical attack or surgical policies, and I'm seeing that Trump using the same kind of language. He says this is like a patient being operated. Sorry, U.S. economy is currently really sick, and it's like a patient, and it's being operated on with this massive procedure, and there will be a little bit of suffering, but we're getting back onto it. And this happened in India in the first term of Modi when he demonetized a large amount of India's currency. Some of the notes which were in circulation were just made invalid overnight, and this had huge impact on India's economy. But eventually he's winning a second and third term, Modi did. And so he's probably Trump's probably looking at these examples from across the world. And this globalized neoliberal economy, although it has benefited the ruling class so much, we have a situation where the top 1% owns, so much of the wealth. 1% of the population own 44% of the entire global wealth. So it really benefited them. But when it comes to the vast majority of people in the United States, in the West, they haven't benefited from this. And they are really, angry, and there's unrest. And this is why the establishment keeps failing, right? In the United States, Kamala Harris fails. So Trump probably knows that his mandate is therefore not continuing what was going on, but to mix things up. So it's really not clear what is behind this, but most of the analysts, like, the big economists, which I was watching on CNBC, some of the, big opinion makers, all saying and predicting that this action, which actually disempowers the US empire, will not go forward. They are predicting that Trump will either withdraw these within, the next week or coming weeks, or they're all kind of encouraging the other mechanisms like that check the executive power, whether it is, the Congress, the Senate, but also the courts, to stand up against this and check Trump's power. So it will be fascinating to watch what's going on, how this is going to result in. But ultimately, there is a consensus among the Western working class who were hit the most by neoliberalism, by deindustrialization, and that this, the whole global free trade stuff, the WTO, neoliberalism, the cutting of services, but also the taking out of all the industries from the West, has not benefited the vast majority of people in the West. And this is that consensus breaking is what is resulting in these sorts of policies by Trump and others. But we'll see what the impacts are, whether Trump is going to withdraw this, because the backlash is so huge. We'll have to wait and see.
I think one of the most cynical ways to read this, and I think if Trump does back down on this and does reverse it, it probably at least gives some evidence for this, is that they're just crashing the economy from the top so that all their rich mates can buy the dip, right? Like let's crash the stock market, let's bowl over a whole bunch of smaller businesses, let's crash the share price of a bunch of big industries, and then all my billionaire mates are gonna buy it when it's at rock bottom. And as you say, this is pure neoliberalism. This is how it operates. It's like, okay, we've run out of ways to funnel wealth to the top 1%. Here's another novel way to do it. We're gonna kill people en masse just by putting some charts up on international television. Like you said, we'll see what happens. The other thing is like, it's a really tried and true on-ramp into fascism to confect a crisis, make everyone's lives worse, and then blame it on the enemy, right? And, it could just be a mix of all 17 of these different things.
I just want to clarify here. I actually think this is great. I mean, I'm really enjoying the fact that, we're seeing the decline of the US empire in real time. This is more incentive, for example, for countries in the global south, which is whose perspective that I'm usually analyzing, these sorts of policies from. These countries can look at alternative places. We don't have to align with the West. Let's have South-South cooperation, right? And this is also an indication for New Zealand to, decouple with this flailing empire, for example. So I'm looking at the bright side of it. I don't care about, the US empire's decline. I do care about the working class people over there, but the end, the death of US imperialism is in the interest of working class people everywhere, including in the United States.
Well, let's quickly bring this back home on that point, because one of the funniest responses here was Winston Peters, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, who just visited the US a couple of weeks ago. He posted saying, "We went to Washington, D.C. to get the best possible result for New Zealand in the circumstances by making strong, genuine in-person connections with the US administration," as if anything he did had any impact here. Like, as if his visit there meant that we had a lower tariff applied. No, mate, we know they just put it into ChatGPT. You fucking idiot. It's so wild to see New Zealand politicians try and like boost themselves off the back of like what is clearly bad for the Western world. They're like, oh, we didn't get hit with like 47% or whatever. Like, why would we? Like, yeah, it's absurd. It's absurd. I was hoping like I'm continually hoping that one of the insane things that the US does leads to some stronger language, at least from New Zealand politicians, But it's not looking like that's happening. The more recent thing as well is this, the fucking head of the NSA being fired on the apparent decision making of a far right extremist who managed to get some office hours with Donald Trump. And that should be yet another reason for New Zealand to be like, we're out of Five Eyes. Like we're done. But yeah, we're not quite seeing that just yet. What is next on the agenda? What else have we got for everyone today? Man, this is the kind of thing that, okay, first up, treaty submissions. That's fucking funny.
Yeah, that's hilarious. So you got a process. You ultimately get defeated through that process. And then you just don't accept your failure and try to find to undermine the, democratic process because it hasn't gone in your favor. That's basically what I'm seeing from David Seymour at the moment.
It just like complete failure to understand reality at this point. And you know it's confected, right? But the claim that 90% of submissions were against his treaty principles bill. And in the last week, he's tried to do stuff like say, oh, we shouldn't put all of these on the record. Most, like by far, the most submissions ever made on a bill, by the way, over 300,000. We shouldn't put these on the record. It's going to take too much administrative time. They're trying to bring the they have brought the timeline forward at the same time as saying we don't have enough time for this, which is just obscene. And then when it came out that 90% of the submissions were against what he was proposing, he said that's just proof that we should make this law. And you're just like, what the fuck are you on about, mate? Like that, what a ludicrous thing to say.
I think there was a gamble, and I think it. I mean, yeah, this is like a 70% belief. I only 70% believe this, but I think there was a gamble on the part of David Seymour where, because of the circles he moves in, he assumed that this law would be much more popular than it was, and was banking on having at least maybe 30, 25% of submissions in favor. And then being able to use that is to spin into, oh, we should probably do a referendum then. And you can see that
He's still trying
echoed
to do
in
that.
his rhetoric. He's still trying to do that. But yeah, just like an absolutely catastrophic for him, although he'll never admit it and no one will force him to admit it.
That's the worst thing about it, actually.
That
Like,
is the worst thing.
this is the thing, right? Like the whole plan, and we've been saying this, I think, since 2022, when they were doing a roadshow around co-governance, right, and trying to like push this anti-Māori stuff, is that they're looking for a referendum that they can use in 2026 to split the vote as a identity politics wedge, similar to Brexit or The Voice. So Brexit in the UK, The Voice in Australia, and they're going to keep trying to do that, And it also, like, most political commentators should know this as well. They should know this by this stage. It's like it's really, 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 really clear. But as you alluded to, PMax, they're not really picking up on this at all. They're going to take them at face value. The thing is, like, there's a secondary goal to what Seymour is doing here, right? He was trying to get enough support on paper to back up his citizens initiated referendum claim. He's still going to try and do that regardless. But the other part of that is just creating enough distrust and discontent in the electorate at the expense of Māori, at the expense of social cohesion. So and it, he has achieved that to some extent. And alongside a media which is just continually failing to interrogate David Seymour or the ACT Party at a level at which their polling and favorability deserves, like even just on the raw numbers, David Seymour is at minus 28% favorability, like lower than anyone else. That's lower than Elon Musk in the States. It's lower than Donald Trump. It's lower than any other politician, except among the media class. And it's just absurd. Like this should, yet again, as many issues should, as school lunches should have, as protecting a sexual predator should have put David Seymour's career underground. Like he should be gone. Like, there is no other reality that should be allowed to exist in a functioning democracy, TM. But they just keep giving him space to do this shit. They keep ostensibly taking what he says in good faith. But at this point, it's just complicity. It's just there are people in the media who are using David Seymour in a specific role as a totem of capital. And he does it better than many others, and he has zero shame, and he doesn't care about getting dunked on and being unpopular, and just failing again and again and again and again, and being reviled, and being cringe and embarrassing, and being just one of the most disgusting humans in the country. And therefore, he is the perfect tool for media and the capital class to hold in this space, and use as their opinion Overton window kind of pusher. And so he just gets away with it. And the media goes, oh, he's actually a pretty smart guy and he's pretty friendly. So, and he just churns out so much PR. He's so good at it. So we just have to publish everything he says and suck him off.
Yeah, the whole Seymour, like,
Yeah.
actually, we need to just have a conversation about this. Why is the left so afraid of having a conversation? I think he's really shown that he doesn't care about it, and we've just discussed this, but really, I think what's worth noting is that it is concerning that he hasn't been called out, and also it's worth noting the function of his repetition of phrases with no bearing in reality and really what that sort of sloganeering means. I think about, I've just pulled up a passage from Adorno's Freudian Theory and the Passion of Fascist Propaganda, and
Just one you had on hand.
I did a media degree, Kyle. And I'm just sort of thinking about, like, I mean, of course, everybody in Frankfurt School, like, really encountered this firsthand the first time, first is tragedy, and now is farce, I suppose. But, I'm talking about that, when we discuss the psychological basis of fascist propaganda, and I think this is how we need to identify ACT and what David Seymour says, really, as, they're not libertarian, this is fascist propaganda. As he says, as we know, fascist agitation has now come to be a profession, as it were, a livelihood. That sounds familiar. It had plenty of time to test the effectiveness of its various appeals, and through what might be called natural selection, only the most catchy ones have survived. And we kind of see and understand the sloganeering and the repetition of it. He comes up with this idea of freezing and draws a line between advertising slogans for the promotion of business and the way that fascist propaganda works in the face of changing reality and the acceptance of that by liberal institutions, and how that legitimizes the advancement of fascist aims. And then a little later in the same passage, he says, in Nazi Germany, everybody used to make fun of certain propagandistic phrases such as blood and soil, Blut und Boden. Jokingly, we called it Blubo, or the concept of the Nordic race from which the parodistic verb aufnorden, to northernize, was derived. Nevertheless, these appeals do not seem to have lost their attractiveness. Rather, their very phoniness may have been relished cynically and sadistically as an index for the fact that power alone decided one's fate in the Third Reich, that is, power unhampered by rational objectivity. The fact that Seymour can say things like, we just need to have a conversation, in spite of all rational objectivity showing that to be nonsensical, and the ostensibly liberal media falling in line with that and allowing him to get away with it, is part and parcel of the advancement of his fascist propaganda. And that is something that we need to be sharply cognizant of. There's no joke at the end of that, Kyle. That's just the media degree talking.
I just want to say, like, this is what's unfolding is it's a good tutorial for, the non-Gen Z people here. If you want to know the meaning of the term cope, right now, what David Seymour is doing is the ultimate example of cope. Like, dude, 90%, you have been defeated in this process. Instead of accepting that defeat, he's just like cope maxing. There's another term for you, boomers, boomers, Gen X, and fellow millennials. We can learn some Gen Z terminology together. Cope maxing.
He's not seething, he's chilling, actually. No, but that's the thing, is that in a way what he realizes is if he can get away with not showing that he's defeated and everybody else pretends it, he is shown his kind of power by fiat, and he wins in that way.
Yeah, and And media have been more than happy to allow that. You know, like that Duncan Grieve piece and the spin-off on David Seymour being the media's biggest critic, but maybe its savior. After like Seymour consistently like verbally admonishes and abuses New Zealand media, like, oh, I'm glad to see News Hub go, you know, essentially like, oh, but maybe that's what we need. Maybe we just need a little bit of that negging. And it could be the way forward for New Zealand media. You know, like there's a point at which it's not just the media being the media, right? There's a point at which you're like, you're in on this. You are in on this. And that point was actually like 6 years ago, but it's becoming more and more apparent. On that note, let's move to our final topic. Which is the smear campaign and hit job on Green Party MP Benjamin Doyle, which is probably the most horrific of these character assassination, dirty politics attacks that I've seen get this much of attention in New Zealand politics. Is that correct? Like within what, 3 days of it kicking off, the MP and their child were both getting death threats, and it has culminated in the media kind of reporting on it at a distance, which is already bad enough, and then publishing an opinion piece by the person who kicked it off.
Yeah, I mean, the most disturbing part of this is that I don't want, 80-plus-year-old crypt keeper Winston Peters to know what the word bussy means.
Too
It's too
late.
late.
Too
We live in
late.
a post Winston Peters bussy world.
Pandora's box has been opened.
Pandora's
Pandora's
box.
bussy.
I just want to say, dude, you're the deputy prime minister. You're the minister of foreign affairs. Why is your role is not simply to sit there and attack opposition parties or target activists on social media? Why don't you talk about what you're doing? Why isn't it that, it's been a while since you've been in power. Why don't you do the things that you promised you'd do when you were running? Instead of that, they're like, are you actually in government or are you in opposition? Why is it that you're just continuously in attack mode when you actually have reins of power? We have a poly crisis unfolding in New Zealand. There's, increasing homelessness due to the policy failures of this government. I mean, the previous government's policies were horrible, but the current government's policies are exacerbating the homelessness crisis. It's indication of rise in homelessness in all the major cities in New Zealand. We're seeing, a hunger crisis. What did it say? One in five New Zealanders are accessing food banks at some point. Crazy numbers coming out of this government's performance, and they have the reins to power, and this is what they're focusing on. The junior most MP in a smaller opposition party, and what he's doing in his personal account, I just don't. Why is it that this we need to focus on this? I'm not as a person, as a person living in New Zealand, a resident of this country. I'm not interested in the personal account of the opposition MPs. I'm interested in the problems facing New Zealand and what solutions you're offering. And this is Winston Peters deflecting attention away from his own failure as a leader who is at the top of this government. And so to me, it's a testimony to Winston Peters' failure in this government that he's just deflecting attention away.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. The government knows that they can't offer meaningful solutions to the problems facing New Zealand because what they're in power to do is to sort their mates out. And so all they really have left in the quiver is trying to denigrate their enemies and just sort of bait on this absolutely terrible hate campaign.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking foul. And I think Chloe Swarbrick and Marama Davidson, when they did the stand up, like completely nailed it. But again, we're in a situation where New Zealand's media are happier, or at least happy to do the kind of like faux objectivity thing. Like some people might be concerned about this, despite like the facts being front-footed by Swarbrick and Davidson like pretty early on, despite there being like very obvious death threats with some already passed on to police, it's not great. It's not a great direction to be going when we have local elections coming up and then an election next year, that this kind of outrageous smear campaign can get into the mainstream media because the deputy prime minister chooses to start posting about it. Because that like wherever it came from or whatever, like doesn't meaningless, right? Like to an extent. It's that it was forced into the public conversation by the second, well, other than the governor general, the third highest ranked person in the country. You know, this is a direct political attack. That's the purpose of it. The purpose of it, you know, Doyle, well, didn't turn up to Parliament this week because there were fears for their safety. This is the purpose of this, is to make sure that communities that the current government wants to target do not feel safe running for or being in political office. They do not want these people to be represented in Parliament. It's a very, very, that's very clearly the purpose. And media saying, oh, well, we got to report it because the Deputy Prime Minister said it, which is true to an extent, but not to both sides of the shit. Just a complete, and like, I don't know. I'm past the point of saying, like, where's the fourth estate, right? Like, oh, they're abrogating the journalistic responsibility. Like, yeah, I mean, it's got worse, but they've been doing that for a while. It's, yeah, I'm pretty at it, honestly.
Yeah, and usually the defense that's run is, oh, well, it's salaciousness. There's a kind of news value in promoting this sort of conflict. But one has to really step back and really and understand the kinds of conflicts which do get reported on and those which do not, because perhaps this drives clicks. I don't know. You know, there is some kind of news value in terms of, well, not news value, but rather profit value in terms of. You know, this kind of bigoted, anti sort of gender minority, gender diverse, sort of homophobic as well, kind of miasma mixture of hate, and being able to whip that up and or, you know, drive people's base kind of disgust or feelings about this, right? And also, you know, the news value of reporting something that the Deputy Prime Minister says, or what somebody who's, you know, involved in media says. This is all sort of true. One can fudge that kind of argument, but one has to look at that against, you know, for example, think of the amount of traffic that could be driven by the House of Cards tumbling down from ACT if you were to do a deep dive or any dive into both Tim Jago and also a lot of the other scandals that have happened and start to draw that pattern with ACT. Tell me that it wouldn't be a lot of clicks on a headline that involved that sort of story. And people have pointed this sort of thing out, I think. And something that I want to say, I don't want to put words in somebody's mouth, but I think Tim, who's Dread Conquest on Twitter, kind of pointed out that the purpose of these attacks really is a kind of bigotry attack. Like, it's not just a distraction, it's also part of this fresh angle on what we've seen in recent years, you know, with the Destiny Church attacks on drag storytime, these kind of homophobic attacks or the transphobic attacks, with these speakers, you know, the supposed sort of free speech angle of Callie J. Keene or whatever her name is, and these speakers coming over. So you see this kind of pattern. And I think this is just another kind of angle. They're trying to find a chink in the armor. And the media is not so much being taken for a ride as I think there's been a transformation to where it is a willing participant now.
Yeah, it's operating the machine.
Yes,
Yeah,
that's a bit of a change, I will say.
yeah, and it feels really clear to anyone who's analyzing, watching the media in the political space, right? I think the other thing just to mention is this consideration that's actually pretty euphemistic by, you know, people closer to the center around like, what should people who want to run to office have on their personal private Instagram accounts? And they should have seen it coming, which is just fucked. Like, that's basically saying We don't want anyone in Parliament who has ever lived, who has ever had an experience that is different from middle white New Zealand, is essentially the very like quick endpoint in the series of steps stemming from that statement. Like, absolutely impossible. I just want to be clear. Like, and even if there had been nothing, these people on the far right, these are far right extremists, by the way, are gonna gin something up. They're gonna fucking come out with something. You know, they were attacking Tamitha Paul for saying things she didn't say. And you had Hipkins, Luxon, Winston Peters, and David Seymour all calling her insane and stupid and shit. And as soon as she was like put on the record about it, like, oh, well, you said these things, she's like, no, I didn't. You know, what I said was XYZ. Like, oh, wow, it looks like everyone just fucking lied. And one really interesting thing that has come out of this in a media sense is this paywalled article from David Fisher over at the New Zealand Herald. Like, I don't know how this got fucking published, where he actually did the like classic journalistic, like objective reporting and objectively reported that what Winston Peters did was equivalent to stochastic terrorism. And I think that's the first time I've seen, you know, this is a term we've used a lot on this podcast, and I use a lot when I'm posting online. It's the first time I think I've seen a mainstream journalist use this term to describe the actions of one of these members of government, of one of these politicians from a right-wing party. And I think that should just be a really clear indication to everyone of this, the change in tenor, and intent and rhetoric of our parties of government, that a mainstream investigative journalist is using or is having an expert and reporting on the use of that term by the expert to describe the actions of the Deputy Prime Minister. Stochastic terrorism. We are in a new age here. And the fact that this article came, I think, 4 days after the fact, which is fine because you want to be doing the investigation on this, right? You want to be getting people on record who are experts to talk about this. Put that behind a paywall. Preceding that were a range of stories that were doing the both sides. Like, the admission there and the kind of curtain being pulled aside by the Fisher piece is that every other journalist or reporter or whatever you want to call yourselves who had both sides to the story previously, that are both sides with stochastic terrorism, where you said, oh, well, there are these points about the attack on the MP, but maybe you should consider doing some terrorism. Maybe that might be also something we should take into consideration.
I just think that, this whole episode and everything that's unfolding before our eyes, whether it's New Zealand or in the United States, it just shows the kind of whole charade that has become of Western liberal democracy. I mean, it just shows that politics is, you can just be at the helm of government without doing much, just attacking the opposition and creating deflections and, deflecting the attention of the people away and, coming up with these kind of cons to capture the attention of people, whatever. The governance is not happening. The policies are not happening. Earlier, I said it's not one in five, actually. It's 500,000 New Zealanders accessing food banks. So that's one in 10. And also, we're seeing like unemployment at a 4-year high. It's at above 5% now. It still hasn't peaked. These are the issues that we're facing. And yet, we have these so-called elected leaders. This is liberal democracy in action, completely not doing anything about it. We have this, waste of time, treaty principles bill, which is obviously, a failure, and we're wasting our time and energy on that when we have all these pressing issues on the side. Look at the alternative models, right, to liberal democracy. Look at China. What are they doing? They're building hospitals, they're building rail sector. Their emissions peaked in 2023, and it's declining. They're investing in renewable energy. They're investing in rail. They're investing in schools. They're investing in the future of their people. They're improving the conditions of the people. So, Marx and Engels said it a long time ago, but I think right now it needs to be a wake-up call for all of us that this system isn't working. It's kind of like a popularity contest, and the media are just willing participants in creating this deception of democracy, this deception of a functioning system, when what it actually does is it protects the interests of the ruling class, it commits genocide, it continues the very systems of colonialism. The New Zealand government going to India, trying doing strategic partnership and trying to get a free trade agreement there. We don't have to consult with the Cook Islands, but the Cook Islands have to consult with us on every issue. We're seeing it's a colonial system. Everything that this government does is to protect the interests of the ruling class. I mean, in some cases, we get really dumb ideas like the one coming out of Trump at the moment. But ultimately, liberal democracy is a facade. It doesn't stand for any of the values that it espouses. We're seeing the crackdown on protest rights, on freedom of expression. We're seeing just incompetency everywhere, right? And it's just pathetic to have a situation like this, and the leader, ruling leader, as in the deputy prime minister, focusing on the junior most MP's personal account. Aren't these the guys that want to give more rights to to parents? Don't comment on the parenting. I know how to raise my kid. But then when it comes to, the MPs and the politicians they want to target, they have to comment on their parenting. So it's just like, what do you stand for?
I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up, unless there are any final words from our other
A
co-hosts.
small legal tip for 15 minutes, Kyle.
A small legal tip, huh?
Just the
just a
tip.
small legal tip into the Pandora's bussy. Okay. Let's go, baby.
That's been another episode of 1 of 200. Thank you so much for joining us, PMax, Simone, and Josephine.
Thank you very
Thank
much,
you.
Kyle.
Takite.
Thanks for having me on.
We will be back maybe midweek with some more content. We'll be back next week for our regular attempt to keep on top of current events. Share, like, subscribe. Traditional media is failing us. Come and hang out with us instead. Support us financially. Patreon is in the summary. We need everything we can get. We'll catch you next time.
If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learning all your lessons from your politics, there's no distinction. The road to Parnell is paved with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize a cost me ought to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day. This vindictive, forgetful fucking rain. It feels like we're all